Go to thecognitiverampage.com. Keep fueling the change. Help continue to allow this to happen. None of this would happen without you and your love and your support. Love you.
The Cognitive Rampage, a scientific approach to self-discovery, change, and life optimization, is now available on Amazon. What I do in the book is I fuse the latest research from the cognitive, behavioral, social, environmental, and biological sciences. It's not just motivational fluff and wordplay. Now, I do talk about my own story, so there's some kind of inspiration in there, but I'm not just spinning words and hyping you up with motivational fluff. Whether you need a life change, simply enjoy self-exploration and optimization, want to discover new hidden passions, or reduce the life-altering effects of toil, anxiety, depression, all of those issues, this book is for you. This book is not a cookie-cutter method of steps to follow. You'll customize the scientific framework with your own personal beliefs to build your authentic change. That way you assimilate it faster. It's not just copying my beliefs and telling you step one, step two. These will come from your beliefs as how you extend and build the foundation upon this framework. You'll use this framework throughout your whole life, through every change, and through every age. These are not empty words of motivational spin. This book is an experience. The Cognitive Rampage is based in science and is built from your beliefs. It's a path to help you unleash your desired change. You can apply this method on your own with no harmful side effects.
Okay, great, two forks high, raise the stakes. Risk it all, I take the hate. It's the winning team, get the Gatorade. My guy good, but he's not safe, now.
They try to shut us down and it ain't gonna slap. Only thing I fear is God and he on my side. That's the confidence of God, cause he got me. That's why I really feel like you can't stop me. That's all you got. Come on with it. That's all you got. You can't stop me. You don't got the power, hey. Shut me down. That's not an option. I'm my biggest problem. You don't got the power, hey. Shut me down. That's not an option. You can't stop me.
Welcome to Cognitive Rampage Podcast. Hope you're taking care of you. Hope you're living your Cognitive Rampage tonight. It's been lonely around the Lowry home. Patricia's been gone. Ain't no sunshine when she's gone. Told you I'd be playing that song, baby. But she's over in Arizona hanging out with the family. Gone for a week. Just been me and the dogs. Me and my mind. Which can be a dangerous thing. You may understand that too. Being left alone with just you and your thoughts sometimes, it can get pretty dark. Kind of fun sometimes. You never know. Depends on what day it is, right? Whatever's happening. But, yeah. We're live on the Rampage too. So if you comment here as I'm talking, which I'm sure a few people watching will want to comment and yell at me as as we cover the topic of stoicism and some other topics. So, you know, a couple people typed or commented there on the Facebook post about what they wanted me to talk about. And I want to pull those up, actually. I'm going to pull those up now so I can actually read exactly what you wrote on there. And truthfully, talking about stoicism may answer a lot of the questions that people were posting and wanted me to talk about tonight and cover. What's cool is I'm not in a hurry tonight, so I'm kind of telling myself that, right? I've been trying to keep the podcast a little shorter, but frankly, my baby girl's not here, so nobody but the dogs to hang with, so maybe I'll just hang with you all for a while tonight. And truthfully, if I were to cover everything about stoicism tonight, this podcast would probably run for a month straight. I'd be sitting here for a month trying to cover that philosophical view. It's a long and deep topic all the way back. It's an ancient Greek philosophy actually developed by Zeno of Citium. Forgive me if I say that wrong, okay? I'm just a poor boy from Pine Hills / Ocoee. Born in Pine Hills, really raised in Ocoee, so it's kind of both. Shout out to all my friends in Pine Hills, Ocoee, Claremont, Winter Garden. Those are the little cities in Central Florida that you all listening worldwide may not know about. We are worldwide. We're in every country, actually. That's pretty cool. I pull that map up sometimes like, wow, man. They're probably just going like, what is this idiot babbling about? But it's an old
philosophy, kind of a refinement of cynicism, if you will, teaches the development of self-control, fortitude as a means of overcoming destruction or destructive emotions. It doesn't seek to extinguish emotions, which is what it'll sound like as we start to cover some of this. And if you read the basics of Stoicism, it'll come across almost as emotionless. It's kind of tied to some almost a Buddhism in a way, too, if you will. But it seeks to really transform the emotions, right, by resolute, not by just ignoring them and acting like they don't happen. It's more or less not allowing the emotions to control you. And if you've read The Cognitive Rampage, that's taken right out of Stoicism. The beginning parts of the book where I talk about rational self-analysis, and a lot of cognitive practitioners have pulled from Stoicism. The early practitioners, like my favorite, Dr. Albert Ellis, as well as Aaron Beck, who broke off from Ellis, and took it a bunch of different ways. But a lot of it comes directly from Stoicism. It really is. A voluntary abstinence from worldly pleasures. Now, that doesn't sound like fun, right? An abstinence of worldly pleasures. It doesn't sound like fun to me, because I promise you, before this podcast went live, I was indulging. And I'm indulging now, too, in some worldly pleasures. I got a little beer on the side, hanging out again. It's Sunday. I drink alone. I guess that's happening tonight. And music. You know, I had music playing, you know, all day, really. I was out cleaning the cars, cleaning the house, and partaking in some worldly pleasures, you know. But, you know, it's a voluntary, to get back to the Stoicism, right, or a voluntary abstinence from worldly pleasures, which enable a person to develop clear judgment, inner calm, and freedom from suffering, which it considers the ultimate goal, right, to eliminate suffering in a way, or not eliminate, right? Well, I guess you could say eliminate suffering, but Stoicism is not a set of beliefs or ethical claims, but rather a way of life, right? Now, when we talk about ways of life, look, if we talk about any beliefs or standards, if you will, or stone tablets that are passed down to say this is how you should live, I start questioning those things. I really do. I urge in my book to even question your own beliefs, where those come from. Are they rational, right? They can be changed. I argue many, many times on this podcast that there is no truth. There is no truth, right? Now, when I was writing the book, the idea is if I can get you to grasp for a moment just on that topic that there is no truth, then your brain may be pliable enough to start making some actual changes. Because whenever we're going through things, we really want to believe what we're experiencing is truth. But look, life is suffering, to take from a Stoic view, that life is suffering. And when we have an expectation that life is not, we find ourselves to be let down many times, right? So I talk about there being no truth, because if you can question that, to realize the truths that you've developed in your life are your mere perception. You perceive it to be, so you believe it to be, and then that creates how you think and what you think, down to what you feel, right? And what we feel predicts how we will behave. So, again, Stoicism is not this set of beliefs where I can just run down 1, 2, 3, here's what you need to do, follow these. And we look for that too much, I think, in this world. We look for the easy 1, 2, 3 steps, how to lose weight in just these 3 steps, right? What to eat, what not to eat, right? I don't argue that with nutrition either. It's so open to the person. But I can hear the vegans now yelling at me. And the meat eaters too, right? But rather this way of life involving constant practice and training. So this constant practice, I talk about that in my book as well, about people talk about being humble, right, or believing you'll reach this area of this being humble, like I'm a humble person. Simply stating that is contradictory to what you're actually stating, right? But more of a practice, right? We have the practice of humility, and Stoicism is more that, is a practice involving constant practice and training, right, and incorporating the practice of logic. You know, a dialogue and self-dialogue. Like I said, this comes right out of my book, to be honest. The very first part now, I believe change, as I'll get into on the second topic, is about fourfold, really. It's not just about changing what you think and how you think. This is where you have to begin, in my opinion. Well, I'd actually say you'd have to begin in biology, because you can try to think your way out of cancer, and good luck with that, right? You have to get the biology under control to begin with, and then we begin to, at least in my book, begin to play with the beliefs, changing those beliefs, finding a rational basis for those beliefs, then, you know, moving on to how we make decisions, how we make choices, and ultimately how we behave, what we do, the people we're around, our environments, etc. That's why I say, simply downloading the Stoic beliefs in a way, or this practice, it is a great way to begin to start your change, if you will. But many people, when they start to approach Stoicism, can't get they just can't go far enough because it begins to question everything that they believe they think life is about or should be about, right? I cover those words in my book too, the determinate words, should, always, never, all the time, right? These things are determinate words and irrational, if you will, right? But again, it's a constant practice and training, and I talk about that in my book, right? It's that practice of changing how you think to change what you think. Now, you can change what you think in the moment, and that can help. But, you know, we can say, hey, you know, my life's not bad. My life is great right now, right? And that may help bring down some redlining for a second. But if your life is really feeling like it's in a bad place, well, a Stoic would tell you, welcome to life, that life is suffering. And only when we download these irrational beliefs that we are to be happy every day. I said that in my video, too, the other day about if you're chasing, I just want to be a happy person. You're trying to be a happy person in a place of suffering. Well, I mean, without the suffering, the happy times that we have wouldn't feel as good as they do, right? So beginning with the practice of incorporating logic, and that's kind of what I mean when I talk about rational versus irrational, is the idea of logic, using logic to really examine what it is that's happening in your life or what it is you're thinking, ultimately what you're feeling, because what you think creates what you feel. I still get annoyed sometimes when I hear people say, you know, I just have a feeling. I have a feeling. Like, no, you don't. You had a thought first, and that created your feeling, and then you kept having that thought, which then emphasized that feeling. Now, I'm not going to argue on the podcast now if you have that gut feeling or whatever these things are, but I even say in the book, try to have a feeling without having a thought. Right? The thought creates the feeling. So, and that's kind of where Stoicism starts, is the downloading of logic, if you will, and Socratic dialogue and self-dialogue. I mean, that's right out of my book, if you will, or I should say my book is right out of Stoicism, right? Listen to my arrogance. So it, like I said, it pulls from a lot of places. So looking at the self-dialogue, how do we talk to ourselves? What's the narrative? Are we talking about rational things, things that we expect to have, things we think we should have, a person we're supposed to be? Right? A lot of people that are going through depression tend to look around and may say, hey, I got so many things going for me. I know I'm not supposed to be depressed, right? And you catch that determinate word, supposed to be? Who said, right? Because you have these things, you're not supposed to feel those things or think these things. These are irrational and not logical, right? Now, a part about Stoicism, right, and looking at the self-dialogue is contemplation of death and a kind of meditation aimed at training one's attention to remain in the present moment. Now, I can't remember. You know what? I want to pull it up because someone actually wanted me to talk about being in the moment and trying to stay present. And I don't want to lose who posted that there. Yeah, it's Don Chaffins, by the way, that commented on there. Shout out to you, man, for the topic. And it's a deep one. Like I said, we may be here a while. But yeah, Graham Turner, we're going to try to get to you too. Does it take time for change instance, for instance, yeah, I'll cover that in the next one. I want to ramble off, but, yeah, abandonment issues on here, tempers, et cetera. Let's see. Well, I don't know. I can't find it right now. It's probably over on the Tribe post actually, but, it was about being present and being in the moment. You know what? I will find it right now, buddy, because I'm remembering. I believe it was Mike was your name. He's in the Tribe of Change. If you're not in the Tribe of Change, look it up on Facebook as a closed group. One of the wonderful moderators of that group will do a little background check on you and make sure you're not a troll, etc., and let you in the tribe. But a great, great group of supportive people in that tribe. There you go. Oh, great, Mike, you would have that name. Santo Pedro, maybe? Santo Pedro? I'm trying to roll the R there. No. I think, Mike, you were asking how to be more present. You were asking, and not think too. How to be more present in the moment when you're with someone you love or a group of people, whether it is family or friends, and to stop overthinking / not engaging in conversation and planning a few hours from then or the next day or the coming week. A lot of these You say it here, Mike. I'll get to you in a little while with what you further say there. I'm big on always planning ahead, being on top of things and keeping things organized, but lose touch with being in the moment. So this speaks to the stoicism as well, right? Is like a meditation aimed at training one's attention to remain in the moment. Now, this is a great tool. Now, like I said, that's why it's related to Buddhism, if you will. It's about being in the moment, but it's a great tool to be in the moment. And you know what, Mike? I'm just going to address you now because I took some notes down when I was thinking about what you posted today, and I kind of wanted to cover that. So, and I can get back to the stoicism. So it all kind of goes hand in hand. I felt it very serendipitous about the post to talk about stoicism and embracing these, as well as Mike's post, because they go hand in hand, right? And a lot of issues that we experience kind of go hand in hand in this topic, right? So, Mike, I'm going to just kind of read down my notes of what I made for you today to address you, right? You asked about, you know, how to be more present when people are around, etc. So, first, have your plans ever worked out just as they've always been planned to do so? My point is, did you think you would be where you are now 5 to 10 years ago? How good and accurate were your plans, right? So the idea of creating plans to be prepared for the next moment, right, and you're trying to be in the moment while you are making plans, thinking about the future, these also can be little symptoms of anxiety, things we're worrying about. I do it when I feel a little nervous or overwhelmed about things I got to do with work or something, or the podcast or the new book, whatever it is I'm doing. It can be anything. I start to make plans. I'll take notes down, write lists out, right? I try to plan because it gives us this false sense of control. This false sense that we control life, and with this plan, thus we can eliminate suffering, wasted time, whatever that may be, and the reasons that you make notes. So, how well and how accurate have your plans been? Now, if you're planning 2 weeks out, 2 hours out, sure, they may be accurate, right? But contemplate your life 5 or 10 years ago. Did you think you would be exactly where you are now, right? Living in the mystery is the struggle. See, I struggle with that. I struggle to live in that moment and, well, not being able to live in the mystery of what's to come, what may happen, right? So it's a form of control, of trying to have control at every second and every moment. I could probably pull back of why you might be a control freak, Mike, and might feel like you need to have control over everything. There may be some trauma in the background or something there. But living in the mystery becomes the struggle. It's a struggle for many of us. This is what's to come, right? So we plan about it. We may think about it, right? We envision it, as people like to say, right? So first off, it's about that. Thinking about, have your plans really worked out for you anyway? And, oh, hi, Mom. Oh, my mom has chimed in. She's so awesome. My mom's such a champ. She's always sending me cool stuff. Shout out to you, Mom. Love you, Mom. I'm a little busy at the moment, also on a deep topic. But anyway, second, we make plans to try to silence the planning mind. See, we have this mind that's constantly wanting to plan, think forward. I mean, a part of it was survival, right? We had to think about where we were going to eat, where we could be safe, etc. Is this the right step? Is our chessboard set how we want it to, right? So we make plans to try to silence the planning mind. One cannot be in the now all the time either. This is sort of an argument back to the Stoicism as well, right? So they talk about practicing and implementing these to be in the now. So I want you to think about the way of life of Stoicism when they talk about practicing being in the now, understanding life as struggle, and avoiding the expectations, right? That's a huge part about Stoicism, is it's the expectations that we set on ourselves, whether they're societal enforced or parental enforced or self-enforced, right? Over time, they're just self-enforced along with our social enforcement. But think about that for a second as I read through these tips I'm going to give you, Mike, and I'm going to tell you what to try to do to try to be more in the present, more in the now. And I want you to think about someone or yourself that is practicing or is a huge believer in Stoicism that wants to be in the now all the time, because I would tell you that this is irrational to be in the now all the time, okay? So understand this. It is irrational to think that you can stay in the now or even in the other all the time, right? If you're, Mike, like you're saying, you're in the future and the past constantly, And I'm using words like all the time. Again, these are determinate words from my book, right? It's signaling an irrational thought, more than likely. So to think that we can just practice to stay in the now constantly, good luck. I mean, you have to plan, right? What time you got to go to work, or what time the event is, or when you need to pick up somebody, or, right? We have to think forwardly. If we didn't think forwardly and we simply walked around like, hey, all right, we're in the now, we may lose some things, right? Now, again, Stoicism can cover this. It's deep, deep philosophical, okay? It's deep. I'm not going to be able to hit everything and every counterpart of devil's advocate, if you will, all right? But it's irrational to think that you can stay in either one of them. Without learning from our past or preparing for our future, we would not progress or grow. But if we are constantly studying these, we will forget to live. Right? We'll forget to live and be in the now of what's happening, which, Mike, is what you're telling me you're struggling with here, right? And trust me, the people around you will notice. The people around you will notice if you're not engaging and not there in the present with them, right? Constantly in the past or in the future, right? So staying in the moment constantly would leave you seemingly dull. This is my sort of devil's advocate to Stoicism, if you will. And when I say dull, it's right, we can derive meaning from anything we choose to serve meaning from. And my buddy Alvin, he would call me his mentor, but I don't know, whatever. Anyway, he reached out and hit me up one day and said, hey man, I realized that we can find meaning in anything we want to if we just look at it. And that's huge. Yes, I would agree. It's a big philosophical part, kind of lays into the Buddhism part too, but we can derive meaning from anything we choose to serve meaning to or from. Who says what is meaningful? See, that's a question you need to think about. Who says what is meaningful? You? I know it feels like it, right? Or you think like it, I should say. Most people understand if I just say, I know it feels like you know what is meaningful. But whatever you believe to be meaningful, again, this is right into the beginning of my book when I talk about rational self-analysis and breaking down our concrete beliefs to really question, you know, where did I get the idea that this is meaningful? A lot of people think it's your idea, and I'm here to tell you more than likely it's not. Whatever you believe to be meaningful, and that's whether it's family or kids or whatever it is you believe to be meaningful, feels meaningful to you, but I can tell you there's 100 and I say 100. There's a whole bunch of moms and dads driving around in a minivan that are doing what they were told was meaningful and do not think or feel like they are fulfilled, right? That constant search for something they don't even know what they're searching for. So we can make the checklist off of what we're supposed to do in order to feel fulfilled, whether that's money, accomplishment, it can be anything too, helping other people, pick that, right? But who defines what is meaningful? Is it you? Or was it your environment? Was it your upbringing? Was it society? Was it culture? And we can go back to the Stoics of the time that would tell you what would be meaningful or what is not meaningful. They would tell you essentially that meaningful or trying to find meaning is part of the problem. That we start to put meaning into things that begin to build up expectations of self, others, and the world around us. And when we download these things of trying to find meaning in certain things, those expectations is what lets us down and inevitably leads us to suffering. So, who says what is meaningful, right? You have to ask yourself that. And look, I'd urge you, Mike, I hate to pitch my own book here, but I really urge you to purchase it, man. It's $10, dude. And it'll walk you through kind of the rational self-analysis part of breaking down your core beliefs, right? What you believe about self, others, and the world. What is meaningful begins to pop out, and why do you believe that's meaningful? Okay? Because what is meaningful to some is not meaningful to others, right? I mean, we know this. This is subjective in its own approach anyway, which is, again, going back to why I tell you there is no truth. It's what we choose to believe based on our experience, our influence, our society, our upbringing, etc. These are the things to download, aka in quotes, meaning, right? To believe we must, and I put it in caps for you, must is one of those determinate words I talk about. Dr. Albert Ellis would call that musturbation. I must be successful. I must be happy, right? I must get married. I must have kids. I must, right? So to believe we must always be planning to be productive is also irrational, as is being in the moment always. Right? Understand you can't be in both, and you see what's happening when you're not being in the moment at all, right? You can't be present with others, right? People will believe you more than likely to be distant of what's happening. So now that I've kind of wrapped up what you're talking about, here's what to do. Here's what to do. If you struggle to be in the moment, and I'm going to, this is kind of a layman's way of giving you some stoic approaches, but it's some things that you can apply. It's things that you can apply. And remember, stoicism is about a practice, right? Not this achievement of I have arrived, that I am now this stoic, humble person or what have you, right? It's not about this place we arrive. It's a practice. Even in my book, I talk about it's not about being a humble person, because just to think you can get there can be irrational, right? But it's the practice of being humble, right? So here's what to do. If you're in that moment and you find your mind straying off and squirreling off, right, thinking about what you got to do in an hour or 10 minutes from now, I mean, this, now mind you, brother Mike, this is kind of a real surface feeding to you, because for you, it would require a lot deeper reflection to go back of why that's there, why you believe that's important, and what you might be avoiding, right? What you might be avoiding in the present is connection, experience, or you may have some worry, anxiety from the past that's chiming in, that's keeping you moving, right? So here's what to do when you're in that moment. You specifically said there, I'm always planning ahead. How do you be more present in the moment when you're with someone you love, or with a group of people, all right? Ask a lot of questions. Ask a lot of questions to whom you're with. One of the cool parts, or not so cool parts, maybe the drawbacks of our human brain is it can only do one thing at one time. So I hate to burst all of you multitasker wannabes that think that you can multitask. You cannot. You may can do one thing for a little bit, then the other thing for a little bit, and the other thing for a little bit. And there's a lot of research out there where people believe themselves to be super multitaskers, and they perform tons of tasks, and they did terribly. Well, I don't say terribly. They perform worse than those that concentrate on one task at a time. So when you're in that moment with someone you love, ask a lot of questions to who you're with. This keeps you engaged, because the mind is then thinking of the next question. Think about it almost like an interview, right? Think about it if you're live on air, right, and you're doing an interview of something. That's why it's very difficult for people to do interviews. It's a tough thing to do, because you're wanting to listen to your guest, but you also have to be just a step ahead and thinking about a question. What question pops up in your mind? What's next, right? So it'll feed that little part of you that wants to stay just in front of everything. Right, we can't stay just in front of everything. That would be irrational. But it's given that a little bit of line, a little bit of rope to go out there. So ask a lot of questions. It helps keeps you in the moment, because then you have to listen. You have to engage and listen to be able to then prompt the next question, just like an interview. Right? And being observant of what's around you, the weather. People watching is a great thing to do also if you're out with someone you love. And again, this is practice. These are techniques that you can practice along the way. Again, reaching back to the stoic approach to life is the practice of that, of what is logical, right, of staying in the moment. So the weather, people watching, even speaking about what is literally on your mind, past or present, because what's on the mind in the present may be the past or the future. But when we're speaking about it to ones that we love, brother, you will be opening up. You'll be vulnerable. You will be communicating, if you will, right? You'll be talking about what you're thinking in that present moment, not necessarily hiding it and playing that silent chess game in your mind, right? Voicing that to somebody you love is a good thing. It's a good tactic, if you will. I'm not saying it's how everyone should live their life, okay? I'm talking about someone that's trying to learn to be more in the present. So speaking about what's literally on your mind, asking a lot of questions in the present, right? And observing what's in front of you. The sky is blue, those birds are singing, that car drove by, what's that sound, right? These are things that keep the mind focused in the present, kind of steps toward meditation, if you will, another reach back to stoicism. And this creates a conversation many times. When you're talking about, look at that over there, did you think the weather would be this nice? Now, I can hear a lot of you, oh, I can't stand talking about those things, they're meaningless. Look, you got to have the three conversations to appreciate the tens, okay? Our mind can only do one thing at once, so some of these topics may seem mundane and meaningless, if you will, but again, we can apply meaning to anything we choose. And if that is what you're practicing in the time, they're not necessarily meaningless and mundane. Because they're not, because you're accomplishing your objective. So if your objective is to be in the present, then the weather, those people over there, the birds singing, the colors around you, the present thoughts in your mind, these are not mundane and meaningless, because they are helping you accomplish the objective of being in the now. You have to have three conversations to enjoy the tens. That's what I was saying, right? So I used to be that way. I did. I do. I struggle sometimes with the mundane conversations, but I've gotten much better of saying, hey, you know, this is how this person wants to connect. I can connect by talking about this, whether it's sports or something like that. These things sometimes have meaning, sometimes they don't, but they might to the person you're with. And this shows that you're thoughtful, that you are willing to forego your chess game for a moment and engage with them in the present. And when you have those three and four conversations, when those 10s pop up, those 9 and 10 conversations pop up, wow, they're really deep. Patricia and I had one of those conversations the other night. It was kind of unexpected, and we just kind of started talking about certain things, ourselves, our present thoughts, our struggles with certain friends and certain things, and then we just kept going back and forth, and wow, man, it was like a 10 conversation, right off, and it lasted for a while. And so I was able to step back and go, man, so did she, and say, wow, that was a really good conversation. And I thought, yeah, that was a good one. But Patricia and I also talk about the weather. We talk about, you know, UFC. We watch that together a lot. We talk about the birds she sings to, right? So those are just a couple hints, Mike, to help you be in the present with one that you love, right? And again, we have to go back for you, brother, you know, to go deeper into why you believe that is necessary. You know, Well, the way RSA starts out in the book is by asking yourself, what do you believe about self, others, and the world? And eventually you'll get to the point of, you know, take a concrete belief, right? Because you obviously believe that you have this issue. So if you believe that you can't be in the moment, how difficult will it be for you to think or feel you can be in the moment, right? A lot of times people will say something like it's fact about what they feel, and I go, well, yeah, certainly if you believe it. Right, so if we believe whatever it is we struggle with, well, then more than likely we're going to think that way and think and also feel that we do struggle with that. I know it seems basic, but I know you may be going, no, man, why? Why do you feel, aka think, why do you think that you are constantly in the future or in the past? Sounds like you're more in the future than the past here, but why? And then answer that question and go back and forth. Answer those whys, looking for determinant words, irrationalities, if you will. And then you may find out that you may not be as much as you think you are. But at least you'll know what you believe that's directing it there, that's directing it to that path, right? So that's kind of linked, if you will, to Stoicism and the Socratic dialogue, self-dialogue, contemplation of death, and kind of a meditation and aimed at training one's attention to remain in the present moment, right? So in modern usage, the word refers to someone who is unemotional or indifferent to pain, pleasure, grief, or joy, and has little common with the philosophical roots. So when you begin to talk to a Stoic and they, you know, throw a couple of these beliefs or ways of life at you, it can seem like, who the heck would want to live that way? If I don't experience, are you kidding? I'm unemotional, indifferent to pain, pleasure, grief, or joy, having little in common. You know, these things are wrong. It's inaccurate to link it directly to there, which I probably may end up doing as we talk about. But on the basics of it, when people begin to walk into Stoicism and read about a Stoic lifestyle, if you will, well, it seems rather not fun at all. I have a friend of mine that's a practicing Buddhist, right? And he could probably win $1 million, and his response would be, great. Right, it's trying to eliminate the expectations. I've even talked about in relationships how expectations are the number one killer of relationships. When we expect something from our partner or we expect something from ourselves, that those two things can link. When we set those expectations, well, we're asking for some suffering, right? When we expect life to not be suffering, when we expect ourselves to be happy all the time, these are irrational and not logical. I mean, life itself, I mean, just watch one of those Discovery Channels and those animals out there on the Serengeti and tell me life is fair, right? It's not, but we expect it to be fair. We are pressured from all sides of this society and the way we operate that we should be something, that we should obtain something, that we should feel a certain way. And I keep saying should because, again, that's a determinant word in my book. Leo and I would reference it as, well, don't should all over yourself, right? Don't should all over yourself. So as an ethical doctrine, the goal of Stoicism is freedom from passion. Who the heck would want that? Freedom from passion, right? I mean, if you look at so many people, one of their top threes must have in a relationship is passion. We got to have passion. But I even talk in my book about how passion is fleeting. I've done a ton of videos about where people are looking for what they want to do in life and, you know, looking for something that makes them happy. And when they find that or that term that if you do what you love in life, you'll never work a day, right? And I reference that as being BS. Right, so stoicism is a freedom from passion, an ancient sense, an anguish or suffering, because the two are linked through the pursuit of reason. Objectivity, unemotional, and having clear judgment, it teaches indifference and a passive reaction to external events. Right, remember I said my friend would win $1 million and be like, "Great," but what fun would that be? Right, back in my early days of getting into psychology, I used to say, man, I want to experience every emotion, right? That I'm laying on my deathbed going, I felt joy, I felt pain, I felt agony, defeat, I felt victory, I felt all of these emotions. And we could walk down the literary meanings of these things and how they're all wrapped up. Stuart Chase's book is a good book to read to kind of give you a pretty cynical look on the view of language and how it controls our thoughts and what we believe. So Stoicism teaches an indifference and a passive reaction to external events. Basically, imagine not having a response to something. Well, imagine being with somebody that you love and something great has happened in their life and you look and say, good, and go on about your life. See, for me, that's boring. Now, a Stoic would argue me through these emotions of what boredom is, right, and in the present. But it's not the absence of emotion either. I told you I would probably start to cross that line. It's not the absence of emotion either, but it's not, the key here is not allowing those emotions to run our lives, is moving our thoughts to a more rational, logical approach to life, knowing that life is suffering for the most part, and not to respond to those emotions. It's understanding that those things will transpire within our thoughts, within our beliefs that resonate to our feelings, that predict our behavior. Understanding those things will happen, but not responding to them. And again, this is right out of my book, right? It is learn to become an observer of your thoughts, not a reactor. Actually, that's a quote right out of my book, is learning to become an observer of your thoughts, almost stepping out of your mind saying, wow, listen to what those thoughts are doing. Too many times we use the word feel. We just say, well, I feel this. And we skip right by stage one and two. Again, stage one, the seed, if you will, to that feeling is what you believe. And you got to know what you believe. Part two, if you will, the stem to that is what you think and how you think. Those are the two steps, if you will, before you get that flowering emotion. And we also believe we should feel a certain way based on what is happening. And again, you have to be willing to ask yourself, well, why is it I believe I should feel this way based on this event? Is it because someone told you so? Is it because you have tears? But most of the time, we can't do what Leo always taught me, which is pause. Pause for a moment and observe your thoughts, not simply reacting to those thoughts. That on the grounds that nothing external can be either good or evil. Right, that there's an equanimity in the face of life's highs and lows. The Stoics taught that becoming a clear, unbiased, and self-disciplined thinker allows one to understand the natural, universal reason in all things. That if we find reason in things, right, the tiger or the lion chases down and eats the baby. And we're like, oh God, run, right? I'm always cheering for the baby, right? But sometimes you got to cheer for the lion, right? If you didn't get it, doesn't eat, right? These are the natural, this is how natural life is existing, all right? So thus unhappiness and evil are the results of ignorance. And if someone is unkind, it is because they are unaware of their own universal reason. Another way of saying, well, a lot meaner way of saying what I write in my book about rational thoughts versus irrational thoughts, about where your beliefs come from. Your beliefs come from what you've experienced that were reinforced through your environment. How you were raised, where you were raised, right? Our mass media culture, pick it. The music you listen to, our friends, our group, and then what we experience through life, these begin to download what we believe is truth. Now you see why I opened my book by asking you, what if I told you there was no truth? Because if you can begin to grasp on that subject itself, that there is no truth, then we can open up the mind a little further and begin to widen your gaze, if you will. Okay? So, it's a rough way to say it, right? The way that it says, but the solution to this evil and unhappiness can be achieved through the practice of Stoic philosophy, the examination of one's own judgments and behavior in order to determine where they might have diverged from the universal reason of nature. Again, this is right out of my book. It's speaking to you about the rational versus irrational and truth versus non-truth, or the universal reason of nature, right? That the lion has to eat the lamb. That's just how it works, and that we can't necessarily control that. And can we be okay with that? Can we be okay with understanding that for the majority, life is suffering? I mean, you wake up hunting food, generally, or coffee, right? The next day you wake up, and in that hunt, you're suffering. How many memes do you see every day? Or how many times do you say it? Oh, I haven't had my coffee yet. Don't talk to me, right? There's a suffering transpiring at that moment. There's a suffering going on at that very moment, right? So, hence the famous Stoic maximum, live according to nature, both in the sense of the laws of the universe and of man's and woman's own essential nature, reason. That this is really what separates us. Look, people tell you it's our thumb. I'm going to tell you it's the ability to reason, the ability to not simply respond to our instinct, our environment, or our initial, quotes, feelings, right? That is what makes us human, that we can apply reason and say, hey, what is the reason I believe this? What is the reason I think I feel this? That's a better way to say it. Instead of saying, what's the reason I feel this? What's the reason that I think I feel this? Because again, your thoughts are going to create what you feel. In many respects, it bears a remarkable similarity to the ethical teachings of Buddhism. That's what I covered before, which is grounded in four noble truths. One, all life has suffering. Yes. And look, you may appear or look at another life and say, hey, I want that life. If I had $10 million, how many times you hear people, man, if I was that rich, I would never. Yeah, you would. Yeah, you would. I know a lot of very wealthy people, and they have issues too. It's not all okay, but the only reason you feel that is because you don't have $10 million. So it must not be true that if you just had this, if you just had love or happiness, if I just had and then I'll be. I talk about that a lot in the book too. That's, again, irrational thinking, not looking at the idea of one of those four noble truths coming right out of Buddhism, that all life has suffering. Two, that suffering is rooted in passion and desire. I mean, this is the idea of love, if you will, right? Again, Stuart Chase's book, the title's eluding me right now, Tyranny of Words, right? Tyranny of Words talks about the word love and its controlling sense and how it's misused or used a lot of times. He seems like a really unhappy guy when you read through that book, but there's a lot of intellect there, if you will. But that one of the second of the four noble truths in the Buddhism that speaks a lot to Stoicism is suffering is rooted in passion and desire. So think about the relationship you may have had where it was full of passion. Full of this undying sexual passion, connection passion, right? Whatever it was. Did it crash and burn? Is it still going? Again, passion is fleeting. Passion is these things that hit us. We then have these thoughts that create our own feelings, and then we behave a certain way, and we call it, hey, it's my passion. It's my passion to do those things, right? But you have to dive into that, because when we fail at our passion, or if maybe what you believe your passion is isn't your job, well, what's coming from that? Suffering. So passion and desire are the root of suffering. This is a Stoic view. So if you take that view and think about every time you were heartbroken, every time you let yourself down, if you will, in quotes, any air quotes, if you will, right? Anytime something didn't work out, you had a desire for something, a desire for an outcome, thus setting an expectation on self, whether that's a relationship, your current life, your current job, whatever that may be, your current health, whatever that may be, when you begin to set those expectations, Well, you're setting yourself up for direct suffering. Because if we do achieve it, great. Now we've experienced joy, which feels good. We have found joy. Wonderful. I've done it. I've accomplished it, right? And then what's next? Now we have to feed that again. And a lot of this plays into the diagnosis I found at Athlete's Depression. When young athletes go through life experiencing a gigantic high, a social high, a mental high, a physical high, a biological high, when they're going through these things at a young age, it begins to shape self as, where do my rewards come from? I'm socially accepted when I perform well, when I'm on the field, when I'm on the court, when I'm in the gym, I'm feeding myself those things. And then we have this desire to, how do I continue to get that? And then when sports ends, we have this belief or this way of thinking or how we think of how can we continue and what am I passionate about, right? What do I desire? And then as we continue to search for those things, and, you know, again, the key is to being young, raised as an athlete, this forms our belief schema or how we think. And we believe those things to be true because they felt good, right? Those things felt good. And then we pursue them. We're hunting the passion to try to replace that or repeat those same desired outcomes. And when those don't happen, we suffer. And it leads to more suffering, right? So you can see why people would accuse Stoics of being emotionless, right? Where the modern term at looking at Stoics was the misconception I covered earlier, that it's not about being emotionless, about not experiencing life, but it's not allowing those emotions to control your life. The supposed to's, the how I should feel or how I know I feel. And again, like I like to say, how you think you feel, right? Not allowing those to control it. So the third noble truth from Buddhism that's also linked directly to Stoicism is happiness is freedom from the passions. Now that's contradictory to, I don't know, 98% of every influencer on social media nowadays, right? It's contradictory to that. It's telling that happiness is freedom from those passions or those desires. So imagine if, well, I mean, I did a podcast a long time ago and I think it was titled Throw Out the Lists. That you keep, you make these lists of what we got to accomplish, what we got to do, or especially where you got to travel, right? And for you, Mike, what you got to do in an hour, 2 hours, 2 months, that plan, right? Throwing these things out. Imagine if you could eliminate, if you woke up every day and you didn't have this need for a desired outcome or this passion that you had to pursue. Some people will go, oh, wait, what? Life without my passion? Oh, there wouldn't be reason. There wouldn't be meaning. And remember what I said earlier, you can apply meaning to anything. So what you choose to apply the meaning to then sets the expectations that you must then fulfill that passion and then that desire. And when that outcome does or does not happen, you receive an emotion, joy, whatever. And then we're running on the fuel of emotions, not our wisdom, not our experience of what we know or what we believe and understanding supposed to is running our life then, right? Our emotions then begin to run our lives, right? So happiness is freedom from the passions. Imagine that. If you could really live that way, it's hard. I mean, again, this speaks to my book, right? Whatever you believe, when I walk you through the beginning stages of what you believe about self, others, and the world, you're going to state it and you're going to go, well, I believe it because of this. I know it. I know it, right? It's what I say. If two people rode a roller coaster, one person said it wasn't scary, the other person said it was the most terrifying ride of their life, who's telling the truth? Right? It's to the experiencer. So when you're trying to literally apply this noble truth from Buddhism or a Stoic philosophy, that happiness is freedom from the passions, you're like, wait, what? And when you start to feel your mind do that, right, that's the synopsis in your brain's going and rewiring back to a different way of thinking. It can become very difficult to do that. So the fourth noble truth, moral restraint and self-discipline is the means by which one becomes free from suffering. Now, here's where I could argue. The moral restraint. Now, I may believe that morals are missing a lot in our culture today, that they have become fleeting, that through the lack of morals, we begin to see certain perversions in our society and in individuals. And email me if you disagree. I'm sure you'll love to. But to then enforce the idea of moral restraint, right? So moral restraint and self-discipline is the means by which one becomes free from suffering. So holding back, the idea of what we believe to be moral, because these things create expectations, right? When we enforce our moral beliefs on the society, on standards, on others, on ourselves even, that, well, it's moral to provide for your family, to do this, to do that, right? You can consider the opposite too. What happens if the opposite's not there? And it can get really confusing. But if you're able to at least entertain these ideas, entertain these noble truths, if you will, that all life has suffering. Suffering is rooted in passion and desire, or desire of an outcome. That happiness is freedom from those passions. That's the hard one for many people to really download, even myself, right? Because without my podcast, without the flow states, without the energies I feel when I'm around Patricia, my family, when I'm in the water, when I'm outside, right? These are things that are feeding me in certain ways, right? My happiness, those are my passions, are to do these things. And without those, well, then life would be meaningless. And, well, a Buddhist may tell you exactly, right? But you can then apply that meaning to anything that you choose. Right. As an important aspect, though, of Stoicism involves improving the individual's ethical and moral well-being by having a will which is in agreement with nature, and by practicing the four cardinal virtues derived from the teachings of Plato: wisdom, courage, justice, and temperance. Cover that again. Now, see, some of this I would love to break down, which is in agreement with nature. Now, I've heard many people talk about the natural order of things, or the natural laws of things, and I don't know, we could walk down the idea that we're also evolving, that if we stick to these natural orders of what nature is and should be, right, should be, shooting on ourselves, then perhaps we don't evolve, perhaps we don't move forward or progress or digress into something else, right, that the idea that we begin to enforce our moral nature, enforce these things, right? And the four cardinal virtues derived. Now, Plato, I'm telling you, I've read some Plato stuff, and some of it gets really deep. I enjoy it more than I used to. Plato's Republic was actually one of the first philosophical books I read. I think I was a freshman at Jacksonville University, and I made a D on the report of that book. It was hard not to fall asleep reading that stuff at the time, because frankly, I wanted to experience passions and joy and all the wonderful things that come with being a freshman football player in college, right? I wanted to read those things. So I'm reading it going like, what the heck is this guy talking about, right? It's deep. But when you think about the four cardinal virtues, I'm going to cover those again: wisdom, courage, justice, and temperance. Now, these words are very subjective, right? I would apply Stuart Chase's Tyranny of Words here of, these are the words that then begin to run our moral subjective, and then thus can also create expectations. Because if we believe that we're supposed to live by these cardinal virtues, and when someone doesn't, well, we then enforce our own moral fortitude onto those individuals. And then, hey, they're not doing it. It may get you riled up, right? But if you're practicing properly, no one would piss you off. I do laugh when I watch self-proclaimed Stoics debating and arguing on Facebook back and forth with each other, going, you call yourself a Stoic, but yes, all of those comments are typed in caps, and that's about 15 exclamation points. So I'm watching those emotions run you at the moment, as opposed to relying on the wisdom, if you will. And wisdom can be subjective. What's wise? Right? What makes someone wise? Is it their age? Is it their experience? Is it how many books they read? Because essentially, somebody commented the other day. No, it's my boy. My boy Ali reached out. We got in some deep conversation. He's like, man, I just remember you, that crazy dude that was pulling somebody out of a Mustang, beating her ass. And, you know, you got so smart, man. And I said, frankly, no, I'm just reading other smart people's stuff. And most people that we know are reading other smart people's stuff and then regurgitate it, right? I mean, I've talked about my book as being linked to Stoicism here. It's also linked to four other influencers of our life: environment, behavior, biology, and so forth. But that's me researching other smart people. I mean, Albert Ellis, some of these people that I really look up to, some cognitive practitioners, these people are also pulling from Stoicism and on back. I mean, this is a ancient Greek philosophy. I think it's like 300 BC from then. So I think it's John Campbell that says that on the shoulders of giants we stand, or he stood, but we do. We stand on the shoulders of giants that had these thoughts that, you know, someone also tell you there's no original idea, original thought. So what makes the wisdom, right? These are our virtues. Virtues are another subjective word. We could walk down how language becomes controlling in our lives and our own thoughts. Courage. I did a video and a podcast both on courage and bravery, right? Knowing what may happen, but we go anyway, right? Is courage in a sense, but injustice. Now, justice is a big, deep breath. What is justice for what? Are we talking eye for an eye here? Right? What is the idea of justice? They're so open, right? And temperance is being able to, you know, relax and keep ourselves in that calm, right? Keep ourselves controlled even though when those emotions are upon us, right? Temperance is a moderate or voluntary self-restraint, is having a self-restraint. Now that I like is a self-restraint. I would put that as the first virtue, right? Because self-restraint then builds, it takes courage to build self-restraint. And through self-restraint and courage, we can then reach and use our wisdom, right? That's just kind of how I talk in the book. Pause for a moment. Allow the emotions to flow around us. Observe our thoughts, not react to those thoughts. Question the rationalities and asking why. Do we think we should feel a certain way? And then from there, we can be practicing temperance, right? So, for Stoics, living according to reason and virtue is to live in harmony with the divine order of the universe and recognizing the common reason and the essential value of all people. The value of all people. So that, again, is kind of covering the basis of Stoicism, of which I was arguing the other side of, right? Is recognizing the common reason and essential value of all people, including those that don't practice Stoicism. Again, that's when I laugh at Stoics that are arguing, debating, saying mean things to other people. Well, then you're not using reason, virtue, and living in harmony and recognizing the common value or essential value of all people. They therefore promoted egalitarianism and unusually for their day, encouraged the acceptance of even their slaves as equals on the grounds that they are all sons of God, echoing some Socrates here, claim that I am not Greek, but I am a citizen of the world. I like this approach. It's very Buddhist, right? That all things are life, that all things are equal, that all people are equal. It's when people don't live up to our expectations is when we tend to be angry. We tend to respond or snap back at those people. Again, expectations are those things set that create the suffering or the anger that create the responses and when we lose our temperance, right? So knowing that I'm simply a citizen of the world. I mean, when I see the pride in certain cultures, pick a culture, it doesn't matter, right? There's all kinds of parades for all kinds of cultures and we step up for those things. I mean, just look at football, you know, Raiders fans, Dolphins fans, right? Tell somebody that's a fan of somebody that, you know, a Florida Gator fan, the Seminoles are best and you may have a fight, right? So it's understanding that you are not defined by your borders. You are not defined by these things, that you are simply a citizen of the world, right? So they also deny the importance of external differences such as rank and wealth and social relationships. So social importance, whether you're married, not married, have kids, don't have married, or don't have kids, either one of these things, rich, wealthy, poor, they don't have any, there's no difference here, that we are all just citizens of the world. And tell a rich person that the person in poverty has as much social importance as they do. Right. And a lot of times you'll hear people in poverty saying, once I get money, then I'll be. Once I have this, then I'll have that rank or that social importance. That's an issue. A lot of people that are single, a lot of women that are single, a lot of men that are single that are saying, hey, you know, looking at their friends married with kids, etc., and looking around going, man, if I have that, then I'll have a better rank. And I'll have more social importance because then I'll be operating on the moral standards that I was told somehow that I'm supposed to live this way. And how many people do you know that are wealthy or have checked off the boxes of what you're supposed to do in this country that look down on other people that have not accomplished that and choose to divvy out advice to others that have not, as if they're on some pulpit because they've, well, achieved the check marks? I know many of them. Right, so we talk down to other people because we think we are wealthy or because we have degrees or because we're ranked, right? in some sort of social order, if you will, right? But what's the natural order of things? You know, I'd ask a Stoic, if we're to adhere to the natural order of the universe of nature, then, well, the lion eats the lamb, and then the rich tend to run shit, right? So is there an importance there? Is there a natural order to things there? Well, of course not, if we apply that virtue, right, that all people essentially are equal, regardless of those things. To some extent, Stoicism assumes determinism, and that it holds that we will, in any case, do as the necessity of the world compels us. But it holds that we should not obey, not merely obey the law, but to our own obedience and follow the law consciously and deliberately, as only a rational being can. Now, there are some serious laws that I would not follow. I don't believe marijuana should be federally illegal whatsoever. I don't believe in any of the immigration laws, if you will, that are being passed down to a point. We can argue that. I also don't believe in taking everybody's guns away just immediately right away, at least until you get all the unregistered guns first, right? So, I mean, the law part, maybe 300 BC in Greek times, perhaps following those basic laws, right? But again, laws begin to encroach on people's subjective moral values, right? Whether, pick a religion, right? If we take Muslims, right? Take Catholicism. If we then enforce those morals as being law and we abide by those, the issue becomes what law? What law is fair? What law isn't fair? Do we just follow it because, well, that's just law? I know some people that don't smoke marijuana just because it was illegal, just because it broke the law. They'd love to, but it's illegal and I follow the law, so I can't right now, as a rational being can, as only a rational being can. There's some a little bit of bias in there. But, you know, it goes on to talk about the first century AD Roman philosopher and Stoic Seneca the Younger. Shout out to my niece, Seneca, whose name that, and you too, big brother, Noel. Miss you all. Scrolling off there. The most famous and popular philosopher of his day took the subject of anger seriously. Seriously enough to dedicate an entire book to the subject. He saw anger as a philosophical problem and amenable to treatment by philosophical argument. Now, just an irrational outburst over which we have no control. He thought that anger arose from holding overly optimistic ideas about the world, leading to unrealistic expectations, and advised a more pessimistic attitude so that one was mentally prepared for the kinds of things and the kind of bad things that naturally happen, which would therefore not lead to such outbursts of anger. Like, why didn't you finish it on time? Right? The idea that to take a pessimistic attitude toward life, again, it's why a lot of Stoics are frowned upon, if you will, because what we're told, what, 98% of people here on social media, just be happy, get all the negative people out of your life and your life will be fine. And but then you'll also hear, don't have yes people around, have people that question you, and be positive in your beliefs, right? Again, this can be attacked for being subjective in those words, but I'm not going to go there tonight. Any deeper than I already have, but a pessimistic attitude of what will and will not happen, basically waiting for the other shoe to drop. Now, I'm going to disagree here. I'm going to disagree here because, well, no matter what happens in the outcome, whether, let's say, it's a success or it fails, the ride to that outcome is how you determine it to be. Right? So let's say you have a business idea. Let's say it's a relationship and you've started this thing out and you've had great expectations for it, right? You've had an optimistic attitude. You've had optimistic thoughts about it and you've been happy and excited. It's created enthusiasm, motivation, creativity, awesome moments and times. And then you ride it all the way there and failure. It doesn't make it. You can choose at that moment to respond in anger or not. So to simply say, I'm just going to take an umbrella approach at life and be pessimistic the entire time to eliminate the idea that I'll respond in anger or I'll respond in suffering. I'll just assume it's going to fail and then it won't hurt me later. That's kind of a punk ass way out, if you ask me. I would rather enjoy the ride there, no matter the outcome, right? Because it's not about outcome. I say that a lot in the book too, that it's not about outcome. I think a very cliche thing that life's about the journey, not the destination, right? That if, but you can take that optimistic ride there, but if it doesn't work out, it doesn't have to be the end of the world. You don't have to respond in an anger toward it. I think Seneca is assuming that in writing a pessimistic attitude. Because at the moment is when you can then apply the Stoic virtues, if you will, of your temperance and not respond to it. And you can also have the wisdom knowing that not every business makes it, more than likely they won't, that not every relationship makes it, 50-50 in this country, right? And those are just those that are reporting it. So you can have wisdom enough to know that those things may not happen, and I can still be optimistic about that approach. And look, we've come pretty far advanced in the idea of manifesting, of believing things and manifesting these things into reality. Now, just simply believing it and trying to manifest it, sitting there going, I will be successful, right? Okay, look, I listen to every interview before every UFC fighter goes in there, and they all go, oh, I believe it. I've already seen it. I knock him out. I win. I've seen myself with the belt. Well, then they go and get knocked out in 17 seconds. Did the other person just believe more than you? Right? But does it have power? Does it have... I've been doing this long little stupid experiment to where I crumble up a piece of paper and I'll aim it at the trash can like I'm shooting a hoop, and I'll take my time and aim and see if I can make it and then take the shot. And then if I get the opportunity, right, I'll switch my angle or wherever I'm at. I'll crumble up the piece of paper, turn around real fast and just shoot it, and just know that my body is going to know it, that somehow it just knows it. I wish I could tell you the outcome here, but it'd be very biased, but I'm about 50-50. I miss half the time both times. So the idea that we can just rely on the body and mind's response to the situation, I don't know. The jury's still out on that. But there's tons. I mean, look, I'm not a believer in the book The Secret, but we don't have enough information to deny that there is. I mean, there's done research on people's optimistic attitude that have dealt with PTSD, that have dealt with serious trauma. There's a great article, actually, my wonderful mother, Leanne Lowry, sent me. Again, hi, Ma. Was some research done about some prisoners of war that were tortured, that were treated like shit. They were held for a very, very long time, and they looked at their lives after they returned. And people that were going through that with an optimistic belief, right, with a true optimistic belief about the outcomes of the experience, had a much better life than those that had this pessimistic approach, because they were living in suffering at the current time. And then when they got back from it with the beliefs or expectations they shouldn't have been, maybe that can link back to the Stoicism side, but again, that's why it's philosophy, their life outcome did not turn out so well. So just the idea of that mindset, the optimistic mindset, well, we're showing in research can be a lot, right? So the approach, now mind you, Seneca's talking directly here about anger, and I'm scrolling off and using whatever I need to fit my argument. Don't get me wrong, I get that, right? But there's some deep tenets, you know, I mean, this can go on for a very, very long time. So Stoic logic asserts that certainty of knowledge, which can be attained through the use of reason and by verifying the conviction with the expertise of one's peers and the collective judgment of humankind. Good luck getting a collective judgment nowadays. It holds that the senses are constantly receiving sensations, and in the form of pulsations which pass from objects through the senses to the mind, where they leave behind an impression. I'm telling you, this is right out of my book. What you believe has come from what you've experienced. I talk about the senses, what you see. I've done tons of videos where I talk about be careful what you put into your eyes, what you put into your ears. And I'm not talking about eye drops and stuff. I'm talking about sound, music, what you see, right? There's been tons of studies on people that watch local news every night, that watch media or news, whether it's mass media or local news, tend to not be very happy people. Same thing with Facebook. A lot of people that are constantly on social media are showing to have more anxiety than those that are not. Right? So you have to be careful about what we're putting in, because they create those impressions. From those impressions, or what you would call thoughts, those thoughts download into beliefs. Take someone that's, you know, maybe a girl or a guy that's been hurt numerous times in relationships. Maybe they've been in five relationships and all five people cheated on them and they have stepped away. All men are dogs. That's actually what I write about in my book. It was actually pulling from a client that I had. And her name was Mary, I used in the book, and just couldn't be happy, couldn't find a good relationship. All men were dogs, period, because these five had cheated. How many men are there in the world, right? We begin to move into the irrational that way, right? So the mind is able to approve and reject an impression. We're talking about truth here, people, where I talk about that truth has plasticity, that we can believe our truth, we can perceive another truth, we can shape that, right? That the mind is able to approve and reject impressions to enable it to distinguish the representations of reality, which is true, from which is false. Now, they're talking directly back saying, well, we can use reason to understand what is true and what is false. That's kind of what I mean by being rational and observing your thoughts, your beliefs, right? And dissecting those, if you will, all right? So the theory stands, therefore, in direct opposition to the idealism of Plato, for whom the mind alone was the source of knowledge, the senses being the source of all illusions and error. Arguing against that, right? So we can, well, what you see, right? People tell you what you see isn't always what you get. What you hear isn't always what it is. I mean, this is a philosophical rabbit hole, mind you, that I'm trying to wrap up in so far an hour and 8 minutes, which is a long time to be listening to some stoic babbling, for sure, right? But it's giving you things to think about in that. And now, I think I'm going to go back to your name there, buddy, for using this topic, because I'm gonna slow down the stoicism, because honestly, I'm not going to be able to change your beliefs of what you believe anyway, and those that are intrigued by it, feel free to dive down the rabbit hole and open that up. But there you are, Don Chaffins. When you write right here that philosophy, in specific ancient stoicism, and why embracing its tenets will help deal with the chaos we call life. I'm glad that you weren't enforcing a subjective there. I like that it will help, right? That it can help. It may not work for everybody, right? Maybe a little biasy in there, but can help deal with the chaos we call life. If you believe life to be chaos, well, then it is. But maybe it's not chaos if we understand it's just the natural order of the universe, right? That the lion eats the lamb, that crazy shit happens, right? Best t-shirt ever, right? Shit happens. So we have to be careful, too, of understanding what works for us would definitely work directly with other people. Right? We have to be sure that we don't cross over that line, because we start to enforce our own judgment there. All right. Whew. Good God. Moving on. That's a deep topic there, brother. I mean, I wanted to cover at least the tenets of it, the principles of it, and, you know, the basic beginning of it, where, you know, passions and seeking those passions, the desired outcomes, are what lead to suffering. I think really reaches to your post as well, Jeremy. Shout out to you, Jeremy Russell, is what to do if you're unhappy with your job and it's causing so much anxiety in your life that it leads you to vices and addictions, but you're scared to make the changes. Whew, there's a lot of subjectivity there, Jeremy, and just what you're talking. One, assuming that the addictions that you have are vices, then assuming those vices are coming from your anxiety, and assuming those vices and addictions are somehow wrong. A lot of people that are addicted, this is what Zach Rhodes and I talked about. He went much more in depth than I do, and check out his podcast too. I almost slipped my name, buddy. Sorry. Just look up Zach Rose. We talked about it on, I think it's podcast 206. We talked about addiction, that it has this moral implication, that those that are addicted are somehow immoral or disease ridden. Again, I will argue that. I saw someone, Tim Drugan, shared something with me. Somebody posted, again, stating that it's a disease, addiction's a disease, period. It says it because doctors say it, and it's in the DSM. Look, lady, look. Every one of those diagnoses in the DSM-5 that you touted as being fact are theories. They are theories, ma'am. So any diagnosis in the DSM are theoretical approaches. They are symptoms grouped together that we deem something, and we mainly do it so we could treat it something. So simply stating that because it's in the DSM-5 means that addiction is a disease is false. Okay, I'm just gonna leave it there. I've done 6,471 podcasts on this idea. Now, the brain does change, the biology changes when we use over time that create certain things, but calling that a disease, I don't know. I'm gonna lean off of that. It actually enables people, and it makes people lose hope. And I have seen way too many people define themselves as hi, my name is da da da, and I'm an addict. No, you're not. You're being affected by addiction. You are not an addict. You are not your disorder. No one walks around saying I am headache, right? Right. Hi, my name's Adam, and I am cancer. No, you're being affected by cancer, right? So addiction is also simply that. All right. And we have to lose the moral implication of it. Oh, it got warm. So, Jeremy, I hope a lot of the... We've talked a lot in the Tribe of Change. You've shared a lot of stuff. But, brother, you're being really hard-headed, dude. I'm just coming directly at you, man. You're having these concrete beliefs that you're just holding on to. You're hearing a lot of the things I'm telling you. And we've shared back and forth. But you're not... One, you're not believing them yourself. And there's some deep-rooted core concrete beliefs that you're not examining and not being willing to let go of. What do you do if you're unhappy? Well, you've assumed here that you're unhappy because what you feel it, because you think it, and what we think becomes so, right? So if you're thinking you're unhappy, what you're stating here, as opposed to what? What do you do if you're happy all the time? Well, now you're just living in a delusional world. So to think that we're going to be happy or happy all the time, well, this is irrational. We don't live in a utopia here, right? Life is suffering. So the idea that you may be suffering is reasonable. Reasonable. So you're also correlating your unhappiness to your job. What do you do if you're unhappy in your job? Unhappy in your job? Is it? So there's a lot of assumptions here that it's the job that's making you unhappy. Is it your environment? Is it your own health? Or is it your own thoughts that are linked to what you believe that are perpetuating your belief that you are unhappy and it's much easier to target the job? And it is causing so much anxiety in your life. We cause our anxiety, sir, and what we believe, what we choose to believe, right, it's causing the suffering. I mean, I'll link back to the Stoicism here, that it's causing so much anxiety, you're linking those two rather than self-creating that anxiety because you have expectations. What are your expectations, Jeremy? Whatever those expectations are, that is causing so much anxiety, not the job. Look, I'm telling you right now that there's no job out there that you're going to get that you go, oh, I found my passion and I'd never work a day in my life now. No, this is irrational. So the idea is you're holding on to certain beliefs. You're hearing things that we're saying to you and that I've been saying to you, but you're not questioning those things, brother. You're not really going, why do I believe I'm unhappy? I believe I'm unhappy because you're addicted. I believe I'm unhappy because I have vices. See, these are miscalculations here as you're linking your vices. One, you're calling the addictions vices. The vices are coming from the anxiety, is what you're saying, and the anxiety is coming from your job, and your job, thus, is why you're unhappy. Too many expectations here, social implications, that if you had a better job, say if I said this backwards, I would be happy if I had a better job so I wouldn't feel so much anxiety, and then I wouldn't have all these addictions that make me feel like a terrible person, and then I wouldn't be scared. I would not be scared to change. See, you got to get deeper in it, brother. There's a cycle of thought, of how you're thinking, that is rooted into what you believe you're supposed to be, what you believe life should be, what you believe a job should be. If you're tuning into all these influencers, in quotes, by the way, that are telling you, you know, find your passion, right? This is bullshit. Find this. So what you're doing, Jeremy, is, I think, I know about how old you are, and the generation that comes from is defined by what you do. It's defined by your performance and your job. And so if you feel you're not performing anything that's giving back or it seems mundane, then if I just adjust the outside, then I'll be happy and then I won't have anxiety. You got to go deeper in that, man. What are the desires and what are the passions you're looking for, thus that are seeding your unhappiness, your addictions, if you will, your vices, if you will? What is seeding those things? What desired outcome are you actually hunting? And because of those things that you're hunting, this is why you're suffering, sir. Are you able to be free from all passions and desired outcomes? Or are you simply focusing on the desired outcome to be, quotes, happy? Right. It can be an awful loop, brother, and you're not the only one caught in this kind of loop. The idea that someone, why, I'm just going to be happy today, and I'll be happy tomorrow, and every second, every minute. Well, you are, not you, but you, the people that are thinking like that, you're setting yourself up, man. I mean, you're delusional to a point to think that we live in a utopia that we can just be happy like that all the time. Careful what you're putting in your senses, brother. Careful what you're putting in your ears and your eyes, what you're reading, what you're taking on of what must happen. When you begin to take on so much of that, it can be a problem. And speaking to Terrence Randall's comment here, shout out for the shirt, bro. Send me some more of that. I love the material of the shirt. If you ever see me wearing the Enjoy Chemical shirt, which is made to look like the Coca-Cola label, It came from Terrence and the Terry Cloth. Big shout out. The mentoring and mentors, this can be a good thing. I talk about it a lot in my book, but you have to be careful that we don't then thus download our mentors and our mentors' expectations of life and of ourselves, right? Mentors are great to learn from, but I even say it in the book that they're not stone tablets. What we're getting from those mentors can help teach us. And I also say in the book, don't just constantly agree. I mean, Leo and I, we went to bat a couple times, man. We went to bat a couple times about some thoughts, you know what I mean? So, Jeremy, be careful of what you're putting in your life, what you're reading, who you're looking up to, because what we tend to do is look at other people's lives and go, if I just had, then I'll be happy. And that's what you're doing here. If I just had a different job, then I would be happy, and then if I'm happy, I wouldn't have anxiety. We don't live in a utopia, brother. We all feel anxiety on some level or another. We all live in this suffering place, right? There are happy times to it. There are happy moments to it. You know, be thankful you get to breathe. Find gratefulness in things. These are fine. But again, we're setting ourselves up for those expectations, okay? And the fact that you say, but you're scared to make the change. Well, you're scared to make the change, especially if you believe it to be. If you believe yourself to be scared to make the change, then you will be scared to make the change. I know it seems easy, right? So, Matthew Lupel, abandonment issues, consciousness and unconsciousness, negative self-talk, pain, tempers, communication, how much should we help each other versus solving our own problems? I can jump you right there, buddy. That's a lot to talk about that I'm not going to be able to cover in one podcast. Oh, you say it at the end. Take your pick, Adam. Yeah, that's almost a whole podcast to itself right there in just three words. Abandonment issues is the topic by itself. I'm going to leave abandonment issues to another topic, man, because that can touch home for a lot of people. Touches home for me at certain points, too. But they do stem from expectations that we believe we should not be abandoned. Hear my determinant word. We believe we should not be, or the narrative that we've continued to tell and other people's lives that we look at and say they weren't abandoned, so they've made it. If I just wasn't abandoned, I mean, take the subjective approach of abandonment itself of what that really means. I mean, explain why one kid that is abandoned through the worst parts of life grows up to become whatever you call successful and happy, and somebody that had it all goes downhill, right? So abandonment, these things can be good for us in certain terms, right? Consciousness and unconsciousness. I will tell you this, that in all the research since really Freud made the unconscious familiar with people, since his speaking of this unconscious or this idea of ego, there's no research on it. It's still this thing that we say exists. Well, in my subconscious, you know, it exists. We do things unconsciously. I mean, tons of research out there and experts that'll walk down it, but there's almost no research. We have consciousness. We're here now. That's as much as we know. One would argue that we're one of the only animals that knows that we're alive. I don't know. I'm pretty sure those deers and antelope know that someone's trying to kill them. So the idea that they may can't use the word unconscious when they're dying, right? So these are hugely subjective terms with little to no research in the idea of consciousness versus unconsciousness, right? And if you are doing something in the present with your behavior, a lot of times I say, look at what you do as opposed to what you think. A lot for other people too. Look at what they're doing and how they're behaving as compared to really what they're saying or what you're thinking to yourself. Yeah. So, man, pain, temper, my God, Matthew, I'm going to use this for the next one, brother. It goes on and on. I've been babbling for a hot minute, man. How much should we help each other? Look, I've said it a tons of times that, look, we can find help. Like you said there, Terrence, we can find help from mentors, from books, from other people. Gabor Mate would say that everything is linked to environment. And sure, I talk about the environment in my book. That's one of the fourfold parts to change is our environment, right? And how that affects us. But in the end, people save themselves, man. In the end, we make our own choices to get over addiction, to fight anxiety, whatever it may be. In the end, you know, we can have help and assistance, yes. We can be given advice, have different experiences, yes. Environments matter, these things matter, biology, all these things matter. But we solve our own problems. Now, on a global scale, on a tribal scale, once we stopped living in tribal sizes and moved to such giant communities and became global, if you will, it's much harder to come up with solutions that we all agree with, right? Hence the giant divide, almost globally, right? Trust, empathy, giving advice. Giving advice, right, is almost nostalgic to ourselves. I'm doing a whole podcast on advice here. Taking advice, poverty, overcoming insecurity. Good God. Matthew, I'm just going to use that for the next podcast, bro. These are great, Matthew. I appreciate all these. So I already got my topic for the next podcast that I'm going to do next week, Matthew. I'm going to break this down for a while and see what I can pull out of it. Because it's been a long one already. Whew. God. Hope I covered enough of those topics for you all. Yeah, I think I'm done running my mouth tonight, y'all. What's up, Kyle? I see your things automatically posting there. No big deal. I want to appreciate everybody for joining. Nancy, Juan Hernandez, my boy D-Mac. Kyle, again, who's been a guest on the podcast. D-Mac has been a guest. J.C. Gibson joined for a while. Mike, much appreciated your openness, your being vulnerable in a comment about what you're experiencing and going through, dude, and putting yourself out there, brother. I really appreciate those comments for sure. Jeremy, you too, man. You've been so vulnerable in the Tribe of Change and putting yourself out there. Continue to reach out for help like that if it helps, and use that social network to do so. Christopher Weiss, thanks for joining in. And Nicole Kelly White, thanks for hanging out. And David Rivette was hanging out in here too. I can't go up any further on the comments, y'all, but I appreciate everybody joining in and listening, and feel free to comment anytime. Miss you, Patricia. Not the same around the house without you, girl. But you boys done for the night. It's Sunday. I'm going to wind it down. Hope you're taking care of you. Hope you're living your cognitive rampage. Love you.